Lessons from the Nations. Lessons from the Nations. Brother Jim Parkinson.
Now, brethren, I really think that a bit of apology is due for the subject. As I was considering options to talk about, someone suggested, well, why don't you talk about something you know something about? And that sort of severely limited the field. But some time ago, got a bunch of things in the mail, as most of us are wont to do, and I thought, gee, there's a bunch of things from, you know, everywhere from the University of Michigan to the local store, and some of them ought to be interesting to read, but who has time for it all? Into the wastebasket they went. And Teresa said, say, don't you think you'd be interested in this one on the languages here? And I looked at it, and she was right. So we're going to add a little bit of languages to what helps we get from archaeology and understanding the scriptures, the Table of the Nations, and the nations prophesied in various places, like especially Ezekiel 38 and 9 for today. Afterwards, you'll be able to tell me if this should go back to where it came from. Well, at any rate, at the risk of violating our principle of I am determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified, we'll do our best to see what help we can get from some of the modern and not so modern scholarship that bears on the Table of the Nations in Genesis 10. Now, keep me honest so that I don't miss something that I shouldn't miss. But among the things of interest to us, modern scholarship is telling us something about the migrations of ancient peoples, especially those now in Genesis 10 and chapter 11, and about their languages. At the same time, we have some questions, like, who is Gog and Magog? How do you differentiate between Gog and Magog? Also, there's a billion Chinese, or 1,000 million if you think European language, and why are they not in prophecy? Well, they are. Or who were Gomer, Togarma, and so many of the other nations? We'll try to go through these problems. First, let's take a look at Genesis 10:25. We come down to the third generation after the flood, and unto Heber were born two sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. And what does it mean, in his days was the earth divided? Well, it certainly doesn't mean that the continent started their drift at that time, but what does it mean? Brother Sundaraj Gilbert in India gave us a thought that in time after the flood, as the nations began to become unpleasant towards one another, and even nasty to the point of going to war with one another, Noah came to a point where he'd had enough, and he says, all right, you sons of Japheth are going to take the northern countries, you sons of Ham are going to take the southern countries, and you sons of Shem are going to be in between as a buffer between the two of them. And roughly speaking, it would seem to correspond to Shem being from about 25 degrees north to, well, about 20 to 35 degrees north latitude. That would be approximately in this region here. And Ham would receive all of Africa and the other southern lands. And Japheth would receive the northern lands. Now, one of the other things that, before we go on, there seems to be a degree of confirmation of it in Deuteronomy 32:8. And if so, this would put the division of the nations according to their territories somewhere between B.C. 2372 and 2342. being in the days of Peleg, between when he was born and when his son was born. In fact, Josephus says it was right after he was born, or at the time of his birth, although he's not an entirely reliable authority. In Deuteronomy 32:8, Moses is speaking here, when the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he separated the children of men, he set the bounds of the people according to the number of the children of Israel. Now that's a bit interesting, because how many were there of the Israelites who went into Egypt? You number it, including Jacob himself, and there were 70 Israelites who were in Egypt at the time Jacob went in. And you look at Genesis chapter 10, and there are 70 nations listed. I'm grateful to a brother in the Vancouver area for pointing that out. Now, we'll hold that for just a moment, because to help identify some of the nations, a little bit of word study will be helpful. Over about the past 20 years, there have been some people, not religious people, but people in Russia, in the Soviet Academy in Moscow, and some in the university, who have been pursuing what's called Nostratic studies, from the Latin nostra, meaning hour. And Nostratic language is presumed to be the foundation language for a whole bunch of major language groups: Indo-European, Semito-Hamitic, which includes Hebrew, and let's designate these, Indo-European, all of Europe surely, with very little exception, and Semito-Hamitic would cover most of India and Iran, and all the way through the Arabian Peninsula into the northern half of Africa. And we have four more groups to go. The Dravidian, which is the language of black India. Down here in the southeast are where the Indians are the blackest. That's where our brethren are most concentrated, in the Tamil region. In those days, instead of Tamil, it was called Dravidian. And the Uralic languages in northern Russia, including Finnish and Hungarian, the Altaic languages of Soviet Central Asia, all the way through Siberia into Alaska, would seem to include the Eskimo. And then one small language, which they call Kartvelian. It's a people which we call Georgian, nothing to do with the state around Atlanta, but Georgia in the Transcaucasus region. The Russian and Polish call it Grusian. They themselves call themselves Kartvelian, from Kartubo. Now, in addition, to this group, which includes about 58% of the world's population today, there is a second group of northern Caucasian languages, which are associated with the Chinese and Tibetan languages all the way over here, and some American languages, Athapascan and Navajo. Now, one tends to think Navajo, okay, just one more Indian tribe, but about half, slightly more than half, of the North American Indians are of one tribe, and that is the Navajo tribe. Among the other language groups, let's see, that one accounts for another 28%. We have what's called a Niger-Kordofanian group, accounting for another 5% of the world's population. An Austronesian group, which includes this area, originally all the way from Madagascar to the west coast of the Americas, and that includes many other American Indian languages. And Japanese, which is a combination primarily of the Polynesian language, including the Ainu that still inhabit the northern islands, And secondarily, the Altaic or Magog languages of Siberia, the old so-called Tungus group. And thirdly, the Chinese language, all mixed together. So we have over 99% of the world's languages encompassed by only five language groups, and four if you include the Japanese as a mixture of three of them. There is, however, an interesting exception, one that cannot be firmly placed with any of these language groups is Sumerian, or Old Babylonian, the Shinar of early Genesis. It would suggest to us that while it has some things in common with the so-called Nostratic languages or Semito-Hermetic, some things in common with the Chinese languages and North Caucasian languages, there is some reason that their words are grossly different. The best that I can come up with so far is that there was some reason for which they desired to create a language which the other people could not understand. It might suggest, as some have, the Edgar brothers, Hyslop in his book on the Two Babylons, that when a punishment was executed upon Nimrod, that the people desired to go underground for their safety, and so they created a secret language by which they could communicate their plans and dirty works to one another without being identified and caught by the people surrounding round about. And that could help to explain to us in Genesis, the 11th chapter, the fourth verse, "And they said, Come, let us build us a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven, and let us make us a name." Let us make a name for ourselves. Here's the root of the problem right here. Not being satisfied with worshiping the Lord, they desired to make a name for themselves. This should be a caution for our own characters. Do we ever have impulses like that? "Lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth." And what was the Lord's commandment at the end of the flood? "Be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth." And they say, "No, we won't go." Now, it would appear that perhaps the Lord changed the language by creating the circumstances where they felt the need to do the job themselves, similar to the way in which the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart. Now, as to the other languages, almost every other language on the face of this earth can, in one way or other, be traced back to a central stem of languages, and the current thinking among the scholars today is shown in this language tree. The two of greatest interest to us will be the Nostratic and the Dene-Caucasian languages. Nadini means American Indian of the commonest sort, not common in numbers of people, but numbers of languages. And Nostratic, as I say, is that which is supposed to encompass the Indo-European and the Hemeto-Semitic, including Hebrew. It seems almost incredible that if some should think that Sumerian was the most ancient language, otherwise, how could the peoples of the earth completely ditch or eradicate every memory of the most ancient language, even though they'd be spread completely across the globe? No, that's not a reasonable hypothesis. More likely, it is the Sumerian that created the radical change. After all, we have Eblaite now through the archaeological discoveries. I guess Alice knows a bit about that. And it's as ancient as the Sumerian. So the scholars really are telling us things that we would know, but it's nice to have that confirmation. And from the confirmation, we can also draw certain lessons for ourselves about what temptations to avoid, perhaps even how to avoid them. Now, we'll go for just a few words here. We have an ancient word, kara. We're not really sure of this last letter. It could be an A, an E, or an O, but kara, which meant rock. We have this word preserved in our English language two different ways, in the word hard and in the word cairn. We don't often think of the cairns in Australia, but hard comes from the German or Germanic, whereas cairn comes from the Celtic through the Welsh language, meaning a pile of rocks. The cairns of Australia or rock cairns of Australia. We have it preserved in the Polish as góra, meaning that which is made of rock, namely mountains, or in Ukrainian, hora. We have it preserved in Hebrew as har, in the expression har megiddo, or Armageddon, giving us the thought of a mountain, or a mound, or a rock pile, perhaps even the thought of a rubbish heap of Megiddo. A few others that go through a little faster. The prefix ma in the word meant the region of. Ta is a word which meant hordes of people, gobs and gobs of them. The suffix na meant the territory, as you have Indians in Indiana. That's perhaps an Americanism, but you have it also in the European. And down here, a word, vogue. Now, for that, if you'd like to take the handout and turn it to the back side, we see the word Gog preserved in the Hebrew, meaning that which is raised or a roof. But the verb form, sagab, meant to raise. In some languages, the noun form has been preserved, and in some languages, the verb form preserved the name. There is a tribe called the Saka tribe of ancient history. Their descendants are the modern Ossetics or Ossets in the Central Caucasus Mountains. It would be better to show it on this map. In this region here, the Central Caucasus Mountains, and their word Gog means mountain. Well, that which is raised up. We preserve the word in German as hoch, in English high. Our pronunciation is not so great, so our spelling is still a little closer than the German. Russian preserves it as kucha. And there are a number of other languages shown on this list. Some of them seem to preserve the Sagab form as the name of the tribe itself, the Saka tribe, which you can easily look up in the encyclopedias. That's helpful. Meaning the mountaineers. And it goes on as far east as China, where the region of the mountains is the Saka or Shan, their Chinese word for mountains. And we can go on and on until we can get tired of it. But this then gives some indication of what is meant by Gog. It's associated with the thought of the mountain and the mountaineers, the people. In the table of the nations, we have about, exactly 70 nations specified. And some of the groups are numerous. The four that are elaborated, more than half a dozen elements of them, are among Ham, Cush, Mitzrayim, and Canaan. A brother this afternoon told us why there were so many different Canaanites mentioned. Because our enemies, according to the flesh, are manifold. It won't do for us just to beat one enemy back, like pride, that are working together. Okay, we'll give it a try this way now. How's that? Fine. So, with this great territory, the Cushites spread out and split up into many nations. Also, Mitzrayim, Egypt here, we find split up into many different countries all around the Nile River. We find this in archaeology if we look through all of these various dynasties. The historian Manetho is trying to show how ancient Egyptian history was, so he makes them all successes. Well, one of the dynasties is reigning over here, well, another one is reigning here, and another one is reigning here, and another one upstream. That's all that it really amounted to. Now, so much for Ham. We have one of the other peoples, Joshua. Out of 70 of the genealogies, Joshua and his sons account for 14 of them. That's about 20% of the whole list, and yet he is fourth generation after the flood. Why bother to mention so much of him? Well, Joshua was descended from the same ancestry as Abraham. And their expertise appears to have been the entire south of the entire Pacific and Indian Ocean islands, from Madagascar all the way west outside of this part of the map, all the way over through Indonesia and the Pacific Islands and the west coast of the Americas. It's no wonder they have a common language. Another example of that in this word Kara, even down here in Malaya and Indonesia, we have the word Karas, meaning hard, just as we have it, or very close at least. Okay. Now, as we try to identify Gog and Magog, we can look at a few words here, and half the room can see these. Saka, Masagedi, Sogdiana, and Scythian are all words that are used in connection with a tribe or some aspect of it, and the derivation of the meanings helps us to identify these as the Gog tribe. Saka, because that's the verb form in Hebrew for Gog, as we have it here. The construction of the word that Herodotus uses, and the Massageti were a great people. They were the ones that went to battle against Cyrus the Persian and killed him. It comes from Ma, Saka, Ta, the region of the Saka hordes. We have in the southeast, it'd be about in this region here, Sogdiana, now part of Iran. Saka, Ta, Na, the Saka hordes territory, or mountain hordes territory. And finally, Scythian. And there's a reason that we delete the Ma from the Masagedi here. When we have the region of Gog and the Saka people leave that region to go conquering elsewhere, they are no longer in the region of Gog. So instead of Masagedi, they are Saka Ta, or we preserve it as Scythian or Scythian. Now, when the families were allotted their particular inheritance, it would appear for the sons of Japheth that they were given the northern territories. Each one had a portion of one of the great seas, and hence the river valleys that went along with it. For Gomer, which the Greeks preserve as Kimmer, Herodotus talks of them, we have the name preserved here in the Kimmeria or Crimea, and Herodotus speaks of the Kimmerian Bosporus. We know this Bosporus down here in Thrace. The Kimmerian Bosporus, the only other one it could be, is this one up in the north part of the Black Sea, between that and the Azov Sea, Straits of Kerch. It helps us to locate Kimmer or Gomer then. In a moment we'll see that Gomer appears to have had all of this territory plus the great river valleys extending into northern Europe. We go to Magog, and Magog, the territory, the north part of the Caspian Sea, plus the Soviet steppes of Central Asia, and the great Volga River Valley, which of course includes Moscow. This would extend all the way eastward to the Arctic Ocean and the northern Pacific Ocean. Now, why a difference between Gog and Magog? Historically, what we learn is that the Saka people were noteworthy for raising and breeding horses, especially breeding horses for war, the early warriors. Now, you can't raise horses in the mountains nearly as well as you can on the flat lands or prairies. So the raising of the horses and breeding of them took place on the great Soviet steppes of Central Asia, but the capital was always in the Caucasus Mountains. Who are the ones that put together the great encyclopedia, about 12 volumes, biblical encyclopedia, McClintock and Strong. In there they have a bit about Gog, and they mention that Gog is the modern ascetic word for Gog even today. So we have the capital, Gog, and the people are in the region of Gog, a vast region. We go to some of the other people, and I'll try to speed this up just a wee bit. How badly am I doing on time? Not too well, am I? I guess the next one are Madai, or the Medes, and they had the southern part of the Caspian Sea. And who's next after the Medes? Okay, the Persians aren't listed in this table, but now is the right time to bring them up. We remember from Mina Tikal Upharsin that Paris meant division. The Persians were a division of the Medes, a division that later took them over. And who comes next in the table of the nations after we get rid of Madai, or the Medes? That is Javan, Javan or Javan, from which we preserve the word Ionian as the Ionian Sea. And Javan, in turn, was broken down into several more tribes. Elisha, from which we get the Aeolians, or Iter Elisha, or Itali. Among the other descendants are Tarshish. Tarshish is given good identification in Ezekiel 27:12, where it tells about four metals that he brings to Tyre down here on the coast. And those four metals are silver and iron and tin and lead. Now, there's silver and lead found in the Iberian Peninsula. France has about the third or fourth largest steel production in the world even today. They've got plenty of iron resources in the southwest here. But tin is something which England is famous for down in the southwest in Cornwall. There is comparable deposits down in this peninsula, But archaeologically, England was the first to be doing it quite commercially from over 1,000 B.C. ago. So it would suggest then that Tarshish are the Celtic peoples. Now they, like others, had their colonies. One colony they established on the northeast coast of the Mediterranean. So we have Saul of Tarsus. Among the Celts from Gaul, we have those who came across Central Europe when the Celts were flexing their muscles, went down into the Balkans, settled in central Turkey, and hence we have the epistle to the Galatians. We also have a couple of more that bear mentioning. One is the Donanim, or in Chronicles it's called Rodanim. And the D's and the R's sometimes seem to flip back and forth in time. So we have the Dodanim, the Dorians down here, Sparta or Spartans, we hear about them. That was the capital of the Dorians. And also the Isle of Rhodes from Rodanim. And then finally the Kittim, especially Cyprus. The southeast part near Larnaca is still called Cape Kitty from Kittim and the ancient city of Kittion. Now, the scripture speaks both of ships of Tarshish and ships of Kittim. The Romans used the ships of Kittim for the Mediterranean trade. They were quite ample for that. But the ships of Tarshish were much greater. And what would you need greater ships for except the transoceanic trade? Example, in the time of Solomon, he built ships of Tarshish with the help of the king of Tyre, a good one, Hiram. And they went out for 3 years at a time, which would be plenty enough to take them all the way across the Indian Ocean, who knows, maybe even to the coast of the Americas, if there were need for it, and back down here to the south part of Africa. Perhaps that's where Ophir and the golden wedge of Ophir came from, that being the largest producer of gold even today, and back here again. So our ancestors from way, way back certainly had a world consciousness that was lost at the time of the Roman Empire, the Empire of Darkness. Oh, we have two more that we ought to mention, at least briefly. And Tubal-Meshech and Tarshish, Tiras. For Tubal, we still preserve the name in the city of Tbilisi, just south of the Caucasus Mountains in the Kura River Valley. And according to the Russians, that was a city that was established in the 3rd millennium B.C., which is, of course, the time shortly after the flood. Tbilisi in the Georgian language means warm, because around it there are warm springs. And we can see why they call themselves Karkavelian, or Kara Tubal, the rocky mountains of warm springs. And then we have Meshech. That corresponds to part of Armenia today. In Josephus' time, there was a city called Caesarea Mazaka, from which we have the modern Kayseri, Turkey, even today. In Ezekiel 27:13, it says that to the king of Tyre were brought copper goods by three people, the peoples of Yavin, Tubal, and Meshech. Tubal was best known in archaeology as the center, the ancient center of metallurgy. The copper mines were in heaviest concentration in eastern Turkey in the mountain areas. So here we have the copper miners, the copper smelters and refiners, and over here the copper workers in Yavin, or in Greece. We even see that preserved in Nebuchadnezzar's image. What were the belly and thighs made of? Because copper was a watchword of the Grecian Empire. And finally we have Tyre. Tyre became a great nation. His territory was allotted on the west coast of the Black Sea, from which they sort of slur it out and we get Thrace, as the Grecians did. Probably also should be included the names Troas, the area across on the Asian side of the Bosphorus, and Troy itself, the city. But we are perhaps more interested in a colony that they had on the east coast of the Mediterranean, Tyre, or we pronounce it in English, Tyre. At one time, Thrace was the capital of the, of all places, the Roman Empire. When Constantine moved the capital from Rome to the city of Byzantium and named it after himself, Constantinople. So indeed, in Ezekiel chapters 26 and 27, and indirectly in 28, it's prophesying against the king of Tyre. Why? The king of Tyre does in fact, king of Thrace, does become the head of the Antichrist system. Well, I should say the Roman system, which then became the Antichrist system. Now, we should mention perhaps the firstborn of Japheth, Gomer, was split into three tribes. On the north side of the Black Sea, it was split into Ashkenaz and Riphath. Ashkenaz is not too difficult to identify. The Jews from northern Germany, 800 years ago, called themselves the Ashkenazim, or Ashkenaz Jews. They understood it of Germany, too. The Germans had come from north of the Black Sea. In later times, on more than one occasion, they came down and reconquered the area, even as far as the Caucasus Mountains. And in one prophecy, we even find Ashkenaz among those threatening, I believe it's Nineveh, somewhere in Jeremiah. I've got that scripture written down. It's interesting. Then we come to another problem. Who is Riphath or Riphath? We have one tribe in Europe, that's one major tribe that's unidentified with anything, and that's the Slavic tribe in this region. And we've got somebody to identify, and that's Riphath. And the identification is reasonable and also confirmed when we think of Kara Riphath, or the Carpathian Mountains, the original Slavic home. Now imagine if we asked how many can claim at least some ancestry of Riphath, we'd have quite a few hands going up here. Then there's yet one more son of Kimmer or Gomer, and this is Togarma, who also figures in Ezekiel 38 and 9. Togarma in the uttermost parts of the north. Again, Herodotus and others tell us of the Tochari. There was a language now extinct called the Tocharian language. The Tochari were also horse breeders down in this region, in the very southern area. And their language, though, doesn't belong to the Eastern or Altaic language family at all. It's called an Eastern European language. Josephus says they came from Phrygia, meaning this region here. And now we understand what was going on. That we had Kimmer involved also in the south part of the Black Sea, as well as the north part of the Black Sea and much of the eastern part. And when the tribe was broken up by a Saka invasion, that of the Scythians, after they left Magog, then they took their horse breeding into better pastures way east of the Caspian Sea over here. But their language went with them. Now, from Tocharian or Togarma in the Hebrew, the Greeks corrupted that to Thorgama, and then shortened it to Turks. And in the time of the Mohammedans, many of the Tochari, or Turks, went back to the area from which they had come, reconquered it, and hence we have Turkey today. In the Southeast Soviet, we have Turkestan, or Turkmen SSR, still preserved from that. Other hordes of them, in a century or two later, went north up into Finland, which is also a Turkish-type language, and into Hungary, who shared the language. Ah, yes. And just a brief mention of Elam. because we do want to get on to our applications. That's the only thing this whole thing is good for, is the applications to us. Encyclopedia Judaica points out that the word Elam is the Eastern equivalent of Olam. We normally use that of everlasting life. The root meaning is to a vanishing point, like if you see a road on the prairie. The two edges of the road seem to go off to a vanishing point on the horizon. Hence, of all of the tribes of Shem, the one who went the farthest and the fastest was Elam, the one who went to the vanishing point, or he went all the way around here into China and first settled on the Yellow River in the north, or Huang Ho, as they like to call it. And from there they spread out, and today they are the most numerous of the Semitic tribes. Hence, they are shown as the firstborn of Shem. Now, I think we spent a lot of time on that. The main purpose for spending the time on comparing the archaeology and the historical linguistics is that so that we don't pull a dumb mistake, or at least we minimize the number that we pull if we do pull any at all. There is a solid foundation then for the identification. We will see in Ezekiel 38 and 9 that we really have not one block coming against Israel, but there are two blocks involved. In the first block, that's early in Ezekiel 38, we have Gog of the land of Magog, the prince of Rosh Meshech and Tubal, or chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, whichever is correct. And with him, we have Persia and Cush and Put. So again, emphasizing that we have in the picture, we have Magog, the great region of what's now the Soviet Union, the Volga River Basin, the Soviet steppe on east to the Pacific Ocean. And associated with them are Meshech and Tubal. The bulk of what's left of Armenians are on the Soviet side of the border, and Tubal also in this Transcaucasus region. This area is more heavily populated than the rest of it roundabout. And then with them are Gomer and all his hordes. So we're not talking only about Gomer, but apparently also about Riphath and Ashkenaz. Sounds like even Scandinavia, in addition to Germany, is included there in the eastern bloc. And then it calls out Togarma in particular, separately. So not merely Turkey, but we're also talking about this part of the Soviet Union. Could perhaps include Finland and Hungary as well, as being of Togarma. And then Persia, not much doubt about that. That's the area of Iran. And Put are the Berbers of Northwest Africa. Josephus says that there is a river of the Moors called the River Put, even in his day. And then Cush is with him. So we've got all of Africa accounted for, with one exception, that's Mitzrayim. Carl pointed out the other day that I think it's Psalms 83 seems to name most of Israel's immediate neighbors as well. But there is the group in verse 13, smaller group at this point, Sheba and Dedan, with the merchants of Tarshish and all the young lions thereof. Sheba and Dedan are listed among the descendants both of Cush, black, and also Abraham, because the descendants of Cush and Abraham met in the Arabian Peninsula. Dedan is the area of the north, somewhat south of Jordan, but still on the Red Sea, and Sheba down this southern or southwest part of the Arabian Peninsula, which is practically the only fertile part of that peninsula. And then with them, of course, more of the peninsula is included in the term Sheba and Dedan, they were the ascendant peoples of the time, are Tarshish the merchants of Tarshish and all the young lions thereof. In the time of Ezekiel, they had the ships of Tarshish, the ocean-going ships, with all the young lions thereof. We have the Celtic peoples with all of their former colonies, apparently including the Americas, perhaps including Australia and New Zealand too. That remains to be seen. In each case, we have the block of the oil producers and the oil consumers. The oil-producing bloc for the eastern nations would be Iran, Black Africa, which would include Nigeria, now it's 4% of the free world's oil supply, and then in Libya to the north, which is another great oil producer. And the industrial nations of the north, they're the consumers. You have a similar situation here between Western Europe and the Americas, and over here on the eastern side, you have the oil producer, Sheba and Dedan, Saudi Arabia. If the eastern bloc has everything down to Turkey, perhaps even including Syria, and also Africa, possibly including South Africa, where the Semitic Hottentots were, but nothing else, up to Egypt, perhaps including Egypt, then only Israel remains to break the oil supply between the supplier, Saudi Arabia, and the consumer of the West. In other words, I will put hooks in thy jaws and bring thee down. This means only Israel remains, and if Gog can get a hold of the jugular vein of Israel, he's got the jugular vein of the Western Bloc. Now that potentially presents certain problems for Christian people, brethren, because we would expect that we would continue to find brethren in the West and in the East and in the so-called non-aligned nations as well. So here's an opportunity for us to exercise our Christian thought. What is our mission on earth? Is it construction or destruction? It is not to do things ourselves and take matters into our own hands, but to tell the world what the Lord is going to do. Now, one question logically comes to us. Why are there so many different nations that are prophesied against? Isaiah prophesies against many different nations. Jeremiah prophesies against many different nations. Ezekiel prophesies against many different nations. I think earlier this afternoon, Brother Jim Haig gave us a clue that there are many different enemies according to the Spirit as well. And these are displayed for us. We can more easily see the mistakes in other people than we can in ourselves, so the Lord is giving us examples from other peoples, and now let's try to apply it to ourselves. I may be tempted by something different than the brother on the left side of the room is, or the sister on the right side, but we each have our enemies to worry about. Take Jeremiah 50, verse 7, talking about Babylon. Babylon says, we are not guilty because they, Jerusalem, Judah, they have sinned against Jehovah. Do we ever find that, say, some other group has committed an evil sin in the thing that they have done? And what do we do? How do we feel about it? Do we feel, it shows them right, they're being exposed as hypocrites, they had it coming? Or are we sorry to see it and wish that the misfortune had not come to them? How about our brethren that perhaps we have left, maybe coming out of the watchtower or some other place, or brethren who have left us? How do we feel towards the sins of others? Here's an opportunity to apply it to ourselves, lest we say, what I have done to him, I'm not guilty of, because he sinned against the Lord. Isaiah 16:6, Moab, he is very proud. Moab was not one of the great, powerful nations of the world. a small nation. We're not one of the great denominations of the world. We shouldn't even be a denomination. I hope we aren't. Do we feel, well, it's a little flock, therefore aren't we glad we're small and we don't share the sins of others? After all, who is Babylon? Is Babylon just Rome? Or is it Rome plus all of the denominations that have had church-state relations? Or is it every denomination of whatsoever sort? Does it include the little local independent conservative churches? Is it everybody but us? Moab, he is very proud. It's a temptation, isn't it, brethren? Ezekiel 26:2. Tyre was glad to see the fall of Judah. I shall be replenished now that Jerusalem is laid waste. Better we take a lesson from Proverbs 24:17. Rejoice not when thine enemy falleth. And how much less so those who are not our enemies, even those our own brethren. Tyre has said, I am perfect in beauty. Do I feel because I have the truth? I'm great. I'm perfect. Well, a perfect what? But these are temptations that can befall each of us, sometimes at different times in our life. We need to be on the watch for it. Well, Brother Chairman is here, so let's draw our lessons. That's on one of the sides of the paper. After all, knowledge puffeth up. It's love that builds up. So what lessons can we get out of it? What can we get from this that will help us be better followers of our Master? One is more of an intellectual lesson. It helps us to see that Gog is the capital of Magog. Another time we can suggest that we also have Gog and Magog at the end of the millennium. Now, I don't know that there's any geographic significance to be put on where the satanic leaders will come from, but it might also be the character significance as long after the destruction of Sodom. It says in Kings that there were Sodomites in the land, those that practiced the sins of Sodom. So it may be the practicing of the sins of Gog and Magog that are implied at the end of the millennial kingdom. Second lesson, there's many nations showing many sins. We must not avoid most of them. We must avoid all of them. We need to search our characters to root out every one of the last Canaanites, the Canaanites of character. A third item, there are some of these Nostratic words that the modern scholars are getting back to. They're up to a vocabulary of a little over 300. Some of them help to identify the meanings of the names of the nations and hence the nations themselves. Of the various languages, the Kartvelian and the Semito-Hamitic, particularly Hebrew, seem to be closest to the original. Therefore, Hebrew is useful in identifying the meanings of the names, even in most ancient times. Fourth, let's see, I guess that was really the fourth point more, wasn't it? The last point, 99% of the languages are in four different groups. Sumerian appears to be a secret language. So what is the lesson for us? We should not establish a Bible student private language. We should try to get our concepts across. Express them as clearly as we can. Our enemies are not people, but Satan and any that will follow him. We should do our best to help each one that we have opportunity to see the plan of God, the character of God. And as they progress in that, encourage them to be in accordance with his plans. I'd rather not promote theological terminology when I can get the concepts across. For example, I'm willing to go quite a ways. If I'm talking with a Baptist or a Lutheran, I prefer to call Christ's sacrifice the ransom. It's biblical terminology. But if he prefers to call it a substitutionary atonement, he has the right concept, so I'll settle for that. So what we want to do is put forth the word of the Lord to our best understanding. Hold the truth as high as we are able. Let that be our one message. Let the truth dispel the error. What is it that binds us together? I trust that it's the Holy Spirit, because if it is not the Holy Spirit, it won't matter much else what it is. So let us grow in the Spirit, because our two opportunities to witness are in our words of truth and in the Spirit with which we convey our message. And so I hope that we've begun to get some of the lessons from the nations. I'm only started myself.